Right?
Yeah.
I think it's going.
So, good evening. Welcome to this Center for Bioethics Colloquium. My name is Jonathan Moreno. Many of you know that this is part of our course on biopolitics that I'm teaching this fall. Very unfortunate, those of you who are not part of this course, but welcome to those of you who are not. And tonight our guest is Nigel Cameron. I will tell you a little bit about Dr. Cameron, and then he will speak for 20 or 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussion. We only ask that the students in the course get to have the first question for Dr. Cameron. So, Nigel Cameron is president of the Center for Policy on Emerging Technologies, that's c-pet.org, in Washington, D.C., and a research professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He was formerly founding director of the Center on Nanotechnology and Society and associate dean at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology. His books include Nanoscale, Issues and Perspectives for the Nano Century. He's been a visiting scholar at UBS Wolfsburg in Switzerland, a featured speaker at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and a participant in the U.S. European Commission Dialogue on Perspectives on the Future of Science and Technology. He has also represented the United States, in spite of the accent that you will notice, as bioethics advisor on U.S. delegations to the United Nations, and is a member of the United States National Commission for UNESCO. A native of the United Kingdom, he has studied at Cambridge and Edinburgh Universities and the Edinburgh Business School. It's a pleasure to welcome Nigel to Penn.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and while you adjust to my Chicago accent, I will tell you a brief story. We moved here, in fact, almost 20 years ago now, and I was out doing some shopping at the local supermarket, and the young woman at the checkout was being very friendly, very affable, as they tend to be. If you know Britain, you'll know they are not that way inclined there, and they sort of talk to each other while they serve you, you know. Techniques. She said to me, you know, how, you know, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland. I'm British. And she said, how long have you been here? And I said, less than 2 weeks. She said, your English is very good. one can't make these things up, can one? But one can then use them. That's, you know, like a wax nose. You can use that story in various contexts to offend different groups of people. And of course, no one has any difficulty in worrying about offending American educators like my wife, as she now is. It's a treat to be here. And what I'd like to do is offer some reflections upon the context for the biopolitics, if that is the term that we're... Well, it's currently the term du jour. I don't think it's a good term, but that's part of our agenda. The biopolitics of this decade, and I think perhaps that, of the next two or three decades, in a context in which there has been a very great deal of confusion, and I want to suggest some of the reasons for that confusion, and then offer three remarks or three propositions, three observations on how I see things as the basis for the discussion we may then have. And in the process, I'll say one or two things about me and about what I've been up to and what I've been trying to accomplish, and also partly why I think I haven't succeeded. But here we are in the United States, which essentially controls around 75% of global research and development in every emerging technology. That is a rule of thumb. And of course, not simply biotechnology, but all of these other ologies which keep springing from the minds of smart scientists and smart people looking for grants in the National Science Foundation. But however you want to frame the emerging technology family, the US essentially is three quarters the global player. It's a nation which has little policy interest in emerging technologies. And the deafening silence of the Washington community on the implications of these technologies, merely for issues of policy, I mean hard policy issues, is very striking and is a matter of major concern to various persons who are at least informed about the silence. illustrated by the fact none of the major think tanks in Washington is particularly interested in this discussion, and one or two of them are rather loudly not interested at all. Of course, these technologies merely drive the economy and security and everything else. This is a country which is, of course, riven culturally and politically by debates, above all, about abortion, which essentially condition any discussion that one wants to have about anything else, which can, by a considerable stretch of the imagination and the exercise of logic, be connected to the debate about abortion. And this is, of course, the more true the closer one gets to the policy world. And by the same token, to the world of bioethics. And finally, and I think relatedly, it's a country which, among its policymakers, is, in the nature of things, challenged by any effort to develop strategic policy approaches on issues which are not conventional issues, and indeed in which development of strategic approaches to policy is difficult in any case, quite literally for constitutional reasons, because you have a two-year electoral cycle. And I think I'm an admirer of many, many aspects of the American political experiment, which of course was spawned by developments more than 200 years ago, affecting another country of which I'm also a citizen. But it seems to me the constantly political, in perhaps the worst possible sense of political character, of the House of Representatives lies at the heart of many of the difficulties in developing strategy, which I think are pretty fundamental in the policy community and are most evident in the difficulty of developing strategic thinking about technology and its policy implications. So there, by way of some sort of ex parte reflections on the state of things, I'm not going to come with solutions this afternoon, but I would like to offer three observations on the nature of the problems we're facing. First is that I consider that biopolitics, if that again is the term of art we're using, is set to trump every other area of policy, one way or another. That is, we don't know whether these questions are themselves going to reframe the broad policy agenda. They may, and some certainly think they will, or whether they will indeed come to determine a fundamental political realignment or realignments because of the different weighting which they give to traditional and emerging issues of policy. I think the reweighting process is typically how political realignments take place. But there's no question that the issues raised within the ambit of biopolitics, biopolicy, are issues which have that kind of significance. Now, one could say many things at this point, but sufficient to draw attention to the phenomenon of Ray Kurzweil. Any of you going to be in New York City for the Kurzweil Singularity Conference in 10 days' time? Well, I shall be there. I am not a Kurzweil groupie, but I do enjoy his conferences, and I think he raises very.
You're sending an avatar.
Now, I'm going to meet the avatars, but in person. Kurzweil is a phenomenon. Is fascinating, and essentially represents the most aggressive and hopeful, and also technologically smart strand in the national conversation about the implications of technology for fundamentally reshaping human nature and and human possibilities. I spoke to him at his conference last year on the West Coast, partly suggesting to him he do things on the East Coast. I have no idea whether it's my advice he was taking, because I said doing them on the West Coast is one of your problems, and the other problem is that you do them in this cultic kind of context. I'm assuming you all know the concept of singularity, which is his contribution to these discussions. He plucked this term from a sci-fi story and turned it into a technical term for when robotic intelligence essentially takes over But the greeting at his conference last year from the MC was "Welcome, Singularitarians," which doesn't seem to me to add much to the credibility of what he's trying to say, as I pointed out to him. But I do think the questions he's raising are enormously important questions, not being raised by most people who are familiar with the policy community. So, I mean, Kurzweil is an example. One kind of other examples, the debate around the famous, infamous NBIC report of 2002. This was a document emanating from the National Science Foundation. If you want to have a good read, or you want something to send you to sleep and give you nightmares, you can download it from various websites. But this was a report on nanotechnology, bio, info, cogno, NBIC. Conference report, which was considered by many people to be a policy document, and it was in fact the product of the efforts of some mid-level scientific civil servants who were out of control, because they were working in an administration which was not in fact monitoring what was going on. I think that's a perfectly legitimate and mild way of putting it. And they produced this document, which basically was framed in transhumanist terms and sought to embrace the transhumanist agenda as the context for the future application of all of these technologies. And just add a footnote to that. The European Commission interpreted this as a policy document from the Bush administration. Apparently nobody thought of picking up the phone and trying to find out who might be able to give them an answer as to whether it was or it wasn't, and they set up a high-level expert group, which is a Euro-speak term for a very senior commission, which then produced, I think, seven different documents in response to the NBIC document. And when I was asked to go and speak to the European Group on Ethics, which is the Ethics Advisory Group on Technology to the European Commission, a year or two later, and I said, well, I've spoken to pretty much everybody who has any standing in the administration on these issues, and they really hadn't heard of this document. It wasn't, they didn't write it. I mean, I had an undersecretary downloading pages of it on his printer while I was talking to him and expostulating as he saw them. They basically didn't believe me, which of course is part of the problem with the way in which the Europeans have looked at the previous administration. And I, as someone who was a cautious supporter of the Bush administration, was really quite perplexed at their failure to develop the kind of communication strategies which one needs if one is going to engage in technology and look at its policy implications. And I'll say a bit more about that a little later on. But as examples, but my point is that the significance of these questions, whether we go back to Bill Joy's famous Jeremiah, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, which is a document still worth reading, but 9 years later, Wired cover piece 9 years ago. Or indeed the book written a little later than that by Sir Martin Rees, who is, I think, the current president of the Royal Society in London, and a very famous astronomer, astrophysicist, his book Our Final Century, which the American publishers somehow thought Our Final Century wasn't scary enough, and so the American edition is called Our Final Hour. Given that Rees was trying to make a very specific point about the 21st century and risk during the 21st century. But of course, it isn't, I'm sure, the first time that publishers have put a title on a book when the relevant publisher has not read the book. But Rees basically gives house room to what Joy is saying in his listing of risks, and Rees takes the view that it's pretty unlikely that the human race will be around at the end of the 21st century. So, I mean, these are not merely speculative and extreme remarks. The questions being raised by the confluence of emerging technologies and the social order are, it seems to me, indescribably great. And one does not have to take on a Kurzweilian timeline approach. It always seems to be 20 years from Kurzweil's point of view. He was saying it again in the press a couple of days ago. He was saying 20 years, of course, 20 years ago. But one doesn't have to take that kind of timeline to take the view that if you really can interconnect, human brains, and if you can marry us up with robotic intelligence and all the rest of it, that you are fundamentally shifting the capacities of Homo sapiens in a way which may be good, may be bad, but is certainly around 1,000 times as significant as anybody in Washington recognizes. So that's a limited claim that I'm making about the enormity of the implications of these technologies, or at least specifically the enormity, since enormity is a negative term, the enormity of the implications of their not being addressed when they have this kind of significance for the human future. Good, bad, certainly will not be indifferent. Secondly, doesn't seem to me that either the right or the left, however you want me to divide up the picture, I'm not putting anybody here on the left or on the right who doesn't want to be there, but however you divide up, if you like, the body politic of the bioethics community, it doesn't seem to me that the right or the left has much of a clue as to what to do about this. And I know a certain amount about the right, since for certain purposes I would be characterized as a participant in conservative bioethics, although I would sort of kicking and screaming and footnoting my way out of such an accusation at every opportunity. But it does seem to me there has been a big effort on the part of some who will be regarded as conservatives to get into the bioethics agenda over the years and to shape it somewhat differently, and to have an eye at least on these technology developments. Of course, the story of the President's Council on Bioethics, the creation of the Bush administration, I think is an object lesson which will be studied for some time to come. It certainly was unduly criticized by many people, I think, for its political inclinations, which weren't actually quite as coherent as its critics made them out to be, any more than its sort of ethical cohesiveness was. But it did attempt to address some rather profound questions in a seriously intellectual fashion, which more typically have not been addressed at the interface of biotechnology and other technologies and policy. The net result, however, in policy terms, was at best negligible. And I mean, one could say many things about the work of the President's Council. Some of its members are personal friends of mine, and certainly I have great admiration for Leon Cass. But as an exercise in policy, it seems to me it was a disaster. I think thanks to certain misunderstandings about the relation of the academic enterprise and the policy enterprise, and thanks to an unhappy coincidence between the interests of those who wanted to do something about these questions and the perhaps smarter interest of those who didn't want to do something about them and thought this would be a splendid way of pleasing both parties. But the net result was some profound discussion of the significance of technology for human nature, which was entirely removed from any of the various bits of policy apparatus in Washington that actually do address the question of technology and its policy implications. And certainly my hope is that there will not be an effort now to produce some kind of alternative, which will be equally, if you like, flimsy in its impact on the questions being raised by these technologies, because there's no question that they are of exponentially increasing significance. A lot has happened in the last 8 years. A great deal has happened. And one doesn't have to take a kind of Kurzweilian view of the timeline to note that we are in a far poorer position to have these conversations now than we were just 8 years ago, if we think these questions are significant. And that is irrespective of the views that one takes. I think another of the misfortunes of the President's Council experience was in the public mind, certainly in the mind of the way the press characterized its efforts, to identify an intellectual quest for the significance of technology and whatnot with a particular partisan and pro-life position on the embryo. And I want to say a bit about the embryo debate, because I think that is of some interest, and another object lesson in as we seek to find ways ahead. Because by a rather curious set of circumstances, the cloning of Dolly the sheep, which I am, of course, very proud from my homeland of Scotland, just down the road from where I lived for much of my pre-American existence. Britain, of course, also the home of the Warnock Report from the mid-80s, which was really the ground, set the ground rules for the policy discussion of the human embryo over a generation now. And of course, of the world's first, quote, test tube baby, unquote. The coincidence of the cloning of Dolly the sheep back in 1996, with its epiphany the following year, and most of the text still, you know, books people write on these things still say Dolly the sheep was cloned in 1997. It is extraordinary how few people seem to check references these days. Development then, of course, of stem cell research and the coining of the terminology of embryonic stem cell research shortly thereafter. And then the accession of a president who was personally and politically in sympathy with the pro-life agenda produced, I think, all sorts of very strange things. And ironically, the way in which American society is so ready to throw everything into the context of the abortion debate proved, I think, to be the key reason why the embryo, for all the embryo, the way in which the defense of the embryo and drove the debate for the best part of a decade, ended up being less protected in the United States than, of course, the embryo is in most other Western jurisdictions. And I think there are, one could speak at considerable length about this question, but the theory which I have thrown off without any serious research behind it is that there is an inverse relationship between the protection afforded in Western jurisdictions to the embryo and the strength of the pro-life movement within those jurisdictions. Precisely because if you have a powerful pro-life movement arguing about abortion and the embryo comes in as a subset of that debate, then the battle lines are drawn on abortion, and whereas we have in this country basically a very powerful pro-life movement, which is not sufficiently powerful to overwhelm the debate, you end up with, I think, a fundamental mischaracterization of the question of the appropriate place of the embryo in public policy. You go to kind of like Canada, where you have, if you like, a sort of strong, weak pro-life movement, and it almost succeeds in characterizing the debate in those terms and thereby preventing protection for the embryo, but not quite. And so, in fact, in Canada now, the Assisted Reproduction Act provides a good deal of protection for the embryo and outlaws therapeutic cloning. You go to the continent where you have, if you like, weak pro-life movements rather than a strong, weak one as you have in Canada. And you find in France and of course, supremely in Germany, but the standard view among continental European states is a very conservative one on the use of the embryo in experimentation. And of course, in Germany, as you all know, you have the gold standard, if you like, and that the embryo is basically sacrosanct. France is a very interesting case, of course, because France is the largest. It is the most secular of all major Western countries. In fact, the most secular, I think, of all major countries. And in France, of course, again, therapeutic cloning is a felony. It isn't something you get funding for. And as one who's tried to sort of been something of an interlocutor between the European and American debates on these issues and has had pretty much in complete failure in my efforts to interlocute, sitting down with very influential members of Congress who simply don't believe me when I tell them, you know, that in fact, you know, the therapeutic cloning is a crime in Europe and in France and Germany and many other, even Switzerland, for example, which is a very liberal jurisdiction in many ways, because it's not considered to be part of the pro-life agenda, because there isn't a pro-life agenda dominating politics and culture. And in the process, and this point I do want to make, I think the question of the appropriate handling of the embryo in scientific experiment has not been properly tried within the North, within the United States. And I remember I was sitting next to Art Kaplan at a hearing in the Senate, as I remember, one of these many sort of stem cell type events. Around about 2000 or something, I think it was maybe before the Bush stuff came along, and I, you know, basically provided a whole series of non-pro-life arguments for protecting the embryo from deleterious research, which, of course, well, what does one say in a context in which the binarity of abortion determines all? For some reason, the esteemed members of the relevant committee did not buy my argument. But the point I want to make here is twofold. Partly, I do not think the embryo question has been properly tried within the American debate. And I think that it is important, whatever view one takes on this issue, and there are all sorts of prudential and conscientious questions at stake, I do encourage Americans working in bioethics to familiarize themselves with the nature of the European debates and also the Canadian debate on these questions, particularly in respect of therapeutic cloning, which I think is a much more significant issue than the question of the use of so-called spare embryos for research. But secondly, is to indicate the barrenness of conservative efforts to frame issues in bioethics. And not because I'm out of sympathy with them, but perhaps because I am in sympathy with them. But there isn't a great deal, as it were, with which to be in sympathy. Because they have very largely collapsed back onto an argument about the nature of unborn human life, which essentially is a subset of the argument about Roe. And it is not a distinct argument about the nature of the early embryo. And I think this has been very much the impoverishment of American debate, but I think more significantly, I think it does not augur well for the contribution of so-called conservative bioethics to any other issue, because once you move a few inches away from the abortion question, interest falls off exponentially. And I say that with some sadness, because these various overlapping communities are ones with which I have been functioning over the last 30 years. And I think there simply is not a sufficient traction, whereas there are many individuals involved take various views. And of course, I mean, Dr. Cass himself, I mean, certainly would not have been regarded as pro-life in his view of the abortion debate. I don't know what his particular convictions are, but he was not coming from that community. But within the religious pro-life community, gaining traction for any bioethics discussions that aren't ultimately abortion justified is essentially a fool's errand. And I speak as one who's played that part over the years and is now focusing on other things. So some reflections there on what I think has been the failure of conservatives to engage in the broader discussions raised by technology and its interface with human nature. I'm not convinced that non-conservatives, to use whatever term you want to use for the rest, have been much more effective. And I was discussing earlier with Jonathan that I was out at Seattle a week or two ago at this gathering that they had on nanotechnology and ethics I'm very suspicious of nanoethics and neuroethics and, you know, sort of widget ethics. I think the widget ethics approach somehow assumes that bioethics has been a great success. We just adopt its sort of methodologies, and we then resolve the next sort of problem raised by the frontier of science. And I think there are so many levels of illusion in that way of thinking. If these are regarded as subsets of bioethics, well, okay, they're basically this brand extension into, you know, whatever is hot. I mean, if you want money from the NSF, you know, you call it nano. This has been the case for the last decade. You don't call it engineering. Engineering's boring, nano is fun. I mean, yes, okay, I've no difficulty with using branding techniques, but it does seem to me they have ultimately to correlate to something substantive. And I think we face enormously important questions that don't fall, so they don't fall within the pro-life, pro-choice debate. They don't fall within Democrat versus GOP. They don't fall within more traditional left-right, more traditional European-type categories. The outliers are where the interest lies. This is one reason why I like people like Kurzweil, and I like the transhumanist, and he is not quite in that category. He overlaps with the transhumanist. He doesn't go around using the word all the time like people like Nick Bostrom do, who I gather is to be coming here for a visit, and most delightful person, Nick Bostrom, whom I've engaged with on various occasions. And I think the transhumanists are fascinating because of the questions they raise. By the same token, I think the more extreme and the more articulate critics of technology, I mean people like Rifkin and so on, are fascinating because of the questions they raise. I think all the interesting questions come from the outliers. I don't think the answers do. And this is not just because I'm a split the difference centrist. I think I'm some sort of centrist, but not a split the difference centrist. It seems to me the questions come from the outliers, and we should be much more attentive to the questions that are raised by those on the frontiers, and far less deferential to the way the questions are framed from the centre. But I don't think the answers come from the frontiers. I think the answers come through obviously a sort of dialectical process in which those at the centre are significantly more engaged. Thirdly, and a little more briefly, it's not clear what the place or value of bioethics as an academic and disciplinary exercise, for all its significance within particularly the medical and extended paramedical community. It is not clear to me what the place or value of bioethics is within the policy arena. We talked about the President's Council from one point of view. I think the notion of public bodies with bioethics stuck in their name is a fundamental misnomer. If it had been called the President's Council on Biopolicy, it might even have been taken seriously by the policy apparatus in Washington. Once you name it ethics, some ethical issues, of course, drive everything. Policy is the flip side of ethics. It's the obverse, the reverse. Once you frame something as ethics, it either leads to a scandal and a sort of scandalous interest, which has its value, perhaps, but is ephemeral, or essentially it leads to its being sidelined, because it is a very weak way to frame policy questions. If you frame things as policy questions, it seems to me at least you're in the game, even if you're going to lose. I think we plainly need a sustained intellectual engagement with these questions, how that correlates with the way in which the policy machine operates is perhaps the greatest question we face. And I think that all honor to the efforts that Leon Cass and his colleagues made to do just that and to produce serious intellectual products seeking to frame the questions which were entailed in some of these technology developments. Even if the actual value of these products within the policy arena has not been clear, it seems to me that they have basically been engaged in a sort of pre-policy or pre-pre-policy exercise, the kind of thing one would more typically expect to take place somewhere like this, rather than within the curious culture of the Beltway. So it's not clear to me how one proceeds, and precisely it's not clear to me who the actors ought to be. It seems to me, having as the actors people in bioethics, or as Leon Cass put together. I mean, I interviewed him for a magazine shortly after he was appointed, and to seek to sort of, you know, spin out what he was about. And one thing I said to him was, well, I'm interested to look at the composition of people on the commission. Well, he hadn't picked them all himself. He'd had some role in this process. But I said, basically, I mean, none of these people basically is a bioethicist. Now, I mean, Leon would now be called a bioethicist, but I mean, that's really not what he is at all. And I said, I admire the way basically you've gone back behind bioethics. So bioethics used to be interdisciplinary exercise. It was the point at which you met from your disciplines. And I'm very suspicious of the way that bioethics has become a kind of quasi-discipline all of its own. And I think this has not helped us in what we're trying to do. And I think, plainly, we have a lot in common in what we're trying to do, whatever our own perspectives may be on how it should be done. But who are the actors? And it seems to me there are places around this table for investors, for people, the major corporations working using technology, which ultimately is the entire corporate sector, for those in the broader policy community, for those with if you like, any agenda which actually encompasses the human good, particularly in relation to the human body and the human mind. What the forum should be, it seems to me sticking something in a corner in Washington is never going to influence Washington. You have interagency issues, of course, always the biggest problem faced within the policy community. And this, if you like, is the ultimate interagency issue, because it's the interagency issue affecting all of these various agencies which ultimately shape the policy arena for humankind and members of our species. And then, of course, the question of outcome. I mean, what, in fact, is one trying to do here in discussing the impact of these technologies within the policy arena? And perhaps a modest outcome that one could uncontroversially set is to raise by a major factor the significance of this particular conversation. Because unless this conversation become a much more important conversation within the policy community, and of course within the media, which essentially reflect and echo policy discussions and so on, unless it can become a far more significant factor in the way in which leaders frame the fundamental questions which are to be discussed, are free to be discussed, ought to be discussed within the culture, then it may be that these issues will never gain sufficient traction to be taken as seriously as with the proportion of seriousness which they deserve. It is not that things will not happen on these issues, but they will happen by default. And they will happen not least through corporate decision making. They will happen through the kind of short-term, not necessarily dishonest, but certainly dishonorable policymakers making decisions that they know very well don't get to the gravamen of the questions which are entailed in those decisions. But they will happen through sort of sliding and shifting, rather than through being addressed and framed as having the consequence that they do. It does seem to me that whether you're an enthusiast for these things or not, that there is the consequence of the possibility of I was out in Seattle. They're developing, talking of this contact lens with Google on it within 4 years. Well, this is current technology. I mean, this is not requiring something to happen that hasn't happened yet, like curing cancer. This is something that is just toddling along. I mean, the Japanese reckon within 4 years they will have nursing aides who can replace nursing aides working in our hospitals and perhaps shave 0.5% off the healthcare budget. This is not out there a generation ahead. Unless the kind of consequence can be given to these questions, whatever our perspective, whether we want to have bionic eyes and want to have robotic nurses, then I think we shall have deserved those who look to us as those who are helping to articulate and perhaps even resolve the significance of these questions for the human community. Thank you very much.
So, Bajan, I'm going to exercise the power of the chair and ask you the first question, and then we'll open it up. So, I want to test your interesting hypothesis about the equal and opposite reaction of the pro-life movement, which is a provocative notion. And it's, I'm going to sort of respond to my own challenge in the following remark. Take the case of South Korea, where there's a powerful conservative Christian movement, I think it's fair to say, but still very biotechnologically oriented culture. In fact, all of Asia, you didn't talk about Asia, but all of Asia is the real competitor with us in stem cell biology, not Europe, for various reasons, one of which I think you described well. So what are we to say about what happens in Asia, I guess is the question, particularly in a place like South Korea, which is so pro-biotechnology?
Well, I must say, I think, of course, the fascinating story of what has happened in South Korea with Dr. What's his name? Dr. Won, who was the great national hero and was lying in his teeth and so on and so forth. And I remember all these classes of schoolgirls being recruited online to donate their eggs for his research. Middle schoolers and high schoolers and so on by the class were signing up, and then after he was exposed, the story of the truck driver who immolated himself in a public square to protest what had happened to Dr. Won. I think you see a very fragile and naive culture at work, confronted by forces which are beyond its control. I mean, obviously by the possibility of technological treatment, not least gazumping Japan and so on and so forth. And putting, you know, Korea's going to have this whole new face in the world, and Dr. Won was offered free air travel first class to him and his family for life, and he was on a stamp and so on and so forth. I mean, there's something terribly sad about a nation that will behave like that. And this isn't exactly the scientific method at work, you know, sort of treat your scientist in this sort of godlike fashion. And you place all these hopes. And I think that's part of my response. I mean, I think at the same time, you certainly do not see the Korean churches, and of course, substantial Catholic church in Korea, and substantial, quote unquote conservative, although you know, that means so many things in this context, Presbyterian church there, and all sorts of others, and so on. I haven't been to Korea since then. I went there a good number of times back in the 90s. But it seems to me a culture in which these bodies have not framed the conversation. Abortion, of course, is not a major issue in Korea, although interestingly, of course, Koreans date they count their age from conception. I mean, there are many kind of cross currents here. I think plainly it's the case that many in the West are scared, if you like, of ethics getting in the way of our competing with the Asians, which I think is, well, it's a kind of unworthy thought that I hope would not be bruited around here, in that, you know, we have to get on with what's right. And then, you know, face the consequences. At the same time, plainly, and of course this is where China has been, you know, such a sort of mystery, where you have very little in the way of ethical or, you know, human rights type constraints on research conduct. Plainly there may be advantages. But plainly it's the case that the you have not got in these countries, you know, Western style angst and division about abortion, and therefore really you haven't got any kind of public engagement, critical engagement with the question of what you do with embryos, because it's from the pro-life movement these issues have become political. I think what's interesting to me is, of course, in Europe, where you somewhere like France, they just kind of say, well, this isn't what we want to do. This isn't, you know, this isn't a nice way to behave. Humans should not do that. And how we manage, this is a subsidiary point, which is, I think is crucial. I mean, how we find a way to get serious public interest in these questions without basically turning them into other questions, I think is crucial. I mean, the amount of level of public, as you've seen in the polling, I mean, public knowledge, for example, about nanotechnology is completely flatlined over the last 10 years. I mean, the polling says that people know about as much as they knew about nanotechnology 10 years ago as they know now, and it's not very much. Public interest in science and technology in general, and this is extraordinary in a country which has a liberal arts college education system. I mean, you know, two-thirds, what is it, 40-some percent college degrees? I mean, these people have all done, you know, college-level biology. You go to Europe, you can, you know, last biology you have to do in high school in England is probably when you're about 14. But I mean, you have this liberal arts system, which I greatly, you know, admire and embrace, if I didn't get it working a bit more effectively, to get people actually, you know, standards up and people into engineering and technology and so on. I mean, one of my responses, you know, the nanotechnology initiative has a K-12 nano education project. Now, I'm, you know, from what I know, they are not teaching kindergartners like, you know, my granddaughter who just began kindergarten this fall. They're not teaching her how to think critically about technology, which will be a very interesting question. They're just going to teach her about, aren't little things fun? So, you know, you have Alice in Wonderland kind of experience with the children. Now, part of my response to the problem we have in getting people into technology, as well as public attitudes, is if we use the education system to get little kids and up thinking critically about technology and its implications, I think you get a lot more of them going into technology, because it will relate to something else than simply the sort of narrow geekery that often draws people.
So, I'm going to let you call.
Okay.
With nanotechnology, since the beginning of the funding, ethics have been tied to whether they're research grants or education grants. And as you said, people still don't know much about nanotechnology, but a recent study said that almost 30% feel that it's morally wrong.
Well, you know, of course, we live in a culture in which you know, polling is a sort of central, you know, phenomenon. Like, you know, you used to sort of sing hymns around sort of the piano in the middle of the 19th century. I mean, now you do polling. I mean, it's a thing all of its own. And the fact people know nothing about a subject is no inhibitor to the pollsters. I think one of the sad things about a lot of them, going back to your point about I would reframe it. I would say that, yes, the National Anti-Knowledge Initiative has required ethics in all of its projects. I think to say it without the quotes, I think, is perhaps less than candid, because I know how some of these projects have operated, like the sort of week-long user meeting at Argonne National Laboratories, which I and a colleague were asked to present a paper at. This has been 4 or 5 years ago. And this was their big nano, you know, week-long annual thing, and we were the ethics. And we were put in on the early afternoon slot, when most people still at lunch, and we were told, could we do it in 10 rather than 20 minutes, because they were behind with the schedule. Now, that was ethics, you know, check. And I think we've got a lot of checkbox ethics going on in these programs. I'm speaking to the one woman who I think was a communications person, part of the sort of broader nano thing. I spoke at a conference on nano on the West Coast 5 or 6 years ago. She came afterwards and she said, "Well, I know exactly what you mean." She said, "I am the, you know, I'm the co-PI or whatever, you know, on our institutional grant. Who's the non-engineer?" And she said, "They have this new building that costs $50 million or something." I have to get signed approval from somebody else if I want to use the photocopier there. So I think basically ethics has been marginalized by being included in this process. And you've seen nothing like the serious ring fencing of funding for the ELSI program with the Genome Project, which I think in the long term will not help nano engineers at all. But it's just partly because of the way the legislation ended up framing the questions. It said they were all very important, but didn't actually allocate any funding. It's the blind leading the blind. I mean, the notion of people being asked what they think about things they know nothing about, you know, you basically get random responses. The question is how we get people to think critically about things and know a little bit about them. Yeah, back.
I Googled your name right before this topic, and I saw that a lot of your responses or interviews to courses about nanotechnology had to do with human dignity and those sorts of arguments. And
yeah, human dignity is quite a good thing, I think.
I do too. And I think
this is how you build consensus, you know. Keep it thin. Sorry,
but when I think of like the biggest indignities from a bioethical sort of point of view in this country, especially that pertain to everyday life, I think about things like the government putting to death someone who may or may not be guilty. I think about healthcare industry, I think about organ transplant and quality. I guess the question is, are conservative and neoconservative bioethicists at the forefront of advocating for those avenues of dignity? And if they aren't, why aren't they? I mean, why is the nano so emphasized, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think the number of ethicists of any kind who are much interested in nanotechnology is pretty limited. And the conservatives among them will be pretty few, because there are very few conservatives remotely seriously engaged in bioethics at all, which I think is a sad thing, but is a true thing. So I'm not sure it's that they sort of should also be concerned about other issues. I mean, just as I'll give one sort of simple example. I mean, you know, I mentioned Leon Kass once or twice, because his name was a sort of great lightning rod for many of these discussions over the last decade. And some of you may know, I mean, he really cut his teeth in the civil rights movement in the 60s, going down, you know, doing voter registration in Mississippi. I mean, you know, these people who, you know, we have very convenient boxes to pop people into. But I think, you know, you don't understand Leon Kass until you know things like that about him. These people aren't just sort of checking boxes on technology. And I think it's very difficult to, of course, you know, the President's Council on Bioethics produced a book containing essays by pretty much every point of view on the question of human dignity, which is a very interesting question, because I mean, everyone uses the term, just what exactly does it mean? I mean, does it make you more dignified if you have a chip in your brain, or a, you know, if you can sort of take some sort of elective neuropharmaceutical to get rid of memory or something? But does it make you less? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very important question, though. And I have suspicions, you know, that the notion that you could sort of transform yourself into something else and this is even more dignified may actually be illusory. But I think, dignity, of course, is a proportionate term, you know. I mean, it's very, very complex. I mean, that book, I think, it's a very interesting volume of essays. Everyone, you know, from Patricia Churchland, Pat Churchland, some of you will know. I mean, she and her husband write books on the philosophy of the brain. And, you know, and Pat is regarded, if you like, as a sort of bookend in these discussions because of the sort of reductionist view that she would take. But it isn't that she's not also concerned about other things. And I would leave her to put, you know, her own words around these rather complex questions. But she writes in that book about human dignity as well. So there's a complete range of positions there. But yeah, I mean, I think human dignity is the story of the ages. I mean, it's about whether people treat people like people. Now, we are never all going to agree on quite what people are. But I think if you accept that the people question is the question, then at least we can begin to have a social conversation. It interests me that the one global instrument on bioethics is the UNESCO Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights. And I was somewhat involved with that process, and I was very pleased that, in fact, human rights was used as the sort of anchor for the discussion, and in fact, in the naming of the declaration. I think the declaration is not particularly substantive. Well, how on earth do you get all the nations in the world to sign on to something? But I think it does frame the question right, and I think you know, there's a lot to be had by framing questions right, even if you're going to disagree. Tomorrow morning, you're going to really frame the question today. I think you're going to have a much healthier conversation tomorrow morning. And I think framing these terms in terms of human dignity and human rights, even if these are fuzzy concepts, is worth having done. Yeah, you next.
You mentioned earlier that you think that there's a lot of political disinterest in ethics in this country.
But carry on.
I mean, that our political system doesn't focus on ethics and that ethics tends to be marginalized. Why do you think that is, and do you think that's the case in other countries? Why not?
I wasn't suggesting in other countries it's different. I really hadn't thought much about that. I was merely suggesting if you frame something as an ethics concern in the kind of very self-consciously pluralistic character of our contemporary culture, which I think is much more self-conscious of its pluralism than actually is pluralist. I think there's far more actual homogeneity there in people's values and their worldview and so on than they would allow themselves to believe what it's like talking about, particularly, you know, in a university sort of elite context. But I think the one of the problems is if you badge something as an ethical issue, it privatizes it. You know, it's a bit like saying this is the President's Council, you know, on bio opinion. You know, I mean, you probably get as much credibility for that. Well, you think this, and I think the other, you know, and who knows what Joe down the street thinks. And I think, ironically, I mean, within a democracy, it seems to me what is going on here. I mean, obviously, political science is not my deal at all. But you know, anyway, I've got the mic. But I mean, it seems to me what's happening in democracy precisely is you are seeking to develop a kind of highest common factor of agreement on, you know, which is what we call policy. That will frame the activities and the assumptions and so on of the community. And of course, what we call policy is in fact the translation into a public frame of reference of the private ethical views people bring to bear. That seems to me what it is. No, what it is. I mean, obviously, you may get some, you know, lobbyists who will come and, you know, kibosh the whole process by making a political donation, but of course that doesn't happen, does it? Not really in Washington, that's just in the novels. But it seems to me that is what is happening. It's the values of the community, and so far as democracy works well, it does actually translate those values into policy. But if you go around saying this is an ethical issue, it seems to me you are at least 50% saying it's a private issue. If you're saying it's a policy issue, you're saying it's something for all of us. Let's look at what the you know, what the questions are, what justification is, and so on and so forth. So by and large, you know, if you say ethics, I want to say policy. And I think you're then more liable to get a public conversation.
You have some experience in nanotechnology?
Well, I can spell the word. I just experience. I keep going.
And there's a lot of science going on around the use of synthetic DNA molecules to create things, triangles and boxes and lids and so forth. But you never hear that mentioned at all in the context of a stem cell-like debate. Do you have any opinions on that?
Can you explain what you mean by why is it significant you don't hear it mentioned in a stem cell-like debate because it's not talking about stem cells?
Well, scientists will say that you can get stem cells early enough where you can make them from skin cells and you can do all sorts of things that don't touch embryos.
Yes.
And yet everybody's up in arms about anything to do with the phrase, the term stem cells. But scientists also say, well, we can take DNA, which is the roadmap of life, and we're building little triangles and boxes out of it, and yet nobody seems to be concerned about that. I'm just curious.
Well, I tell you, I got an email a few days ago from Nature Biotechnology asking me to write a commentary on synthetic biology. So I'm going to have to Google it. It seems to me, I mean, what you see in the stem cell debate is how the public operate in relation to controversial issues in science in pretty much the worst way you could imagine, but it's how it works. And the people pick up a phrase. And stem cell is a positive phrase. They pick up the word cloning. Cloning is a negative term. This is just the way in which the brand has settled down there in the public mind. And so part of the debates over the last 10 years have precisely been between people who say cloning and people who say stem cell. And so whenever I got myself on television or somewhere debating those things, I would want to keep saying cloning. And it usually worked. I'd also say policy when they said ethics. I mean, you know, this is you know, how you engage in a public debate. Yes, a lot of people like to think stem cells are bad. A lot of people like to think stem cells are miraculous. Many of these people don't know you can get stem cells from, you know, n different sources, some of which are controversial, some of which are uncontroversial, some of which are potentially controversial, like the IPS stuff. I think what you see is that people love sound bites. And if it goes beyond a sound bite, they're not terribly interested. And I think this is a hugely worrying fact. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the Cold War, Reds Under the Beds. I mean, is that the beginning and the end of what there is to be said, you know, about you know, Western relations with the Soviet Union? Well, it was all most people really cottoned onto. And I think opening up some, you know, broader understanding of the sort of differentiating these conversations is absolutely crucial. I mean, maybe synthetic biology is the most terrifying thing on the planet. I think a lot of people who know a lot about it think it's pretty scary. But I don't think the public has yet caught on to that. I think the fact that it's called SynBio may not help. When it does break up, you spell Syn with a Y, but you know, let's just, you know, this is SynBio. SynBerk is the big deal over there in Berkeley, where you know, Berkeley, Harvard, MIT, and so on are doing the main stuff, NSF funding. You know, no sort of brand consultant would have come up with that name for it. Now at the back, you.
Who I think kind of shares your religious background and also your kind of frustration with the religious community to some extent. Do you think that some of this problem, especially in sort of engaging the right but perhaps also the left, is due in part to a rush to the answer rather than a rush to the question? I.e. that people don't really, perhaps in this country, like to frame questions.
Well, you know, I mean, when you get a call from ABC Nightline, as I did too, in fact, several times, you know, about 10 years ago, I mean, it all came and went, but it was a lot fun thing to do. I mean, they're not going to say, we want you to come on and debate with Zach Kaplan or somebody how you frame the question. You know? They're going to come on and say, we want you to debate what you think the answer is. You know, and you've got these sort of, you know, five little 1 minute, 2 minute slots during the half hour when you get your word in. I think one of the problems with democracy, if one could put it in these terms, is that it necessarily simplifies everything. One reason why there's much value, I think, in the two-party system and all the other conventions that have come to enable democracy to work, and why we have, you know, representative democracy, although I think American democracy is less representative in technical terms than certainly British democracy has been. In that, you know, here you've still got a pretty much of a handle on your member of Congress, which is one reason why Americans have much more conservative laws, conservative quote unquote, on things like guns and capital punishment and so on and so forth. Because the people have much more access to the decisions made by politicians. In Britain, most certainly, if you go back 20 years ago, British attitudes to capital punishment were the same as those in the US. They're probably still the same when it comes to murdering children. In fact, you know, maybe they're even more, sort of, you know, because you get a lot of children murdered very publicly in Britain. There have been a number of cases recently. I mean, this has become very much public eye. Now, point is, but you have a gap. Then you have elite people come into Parliament and make decisions about these things. There's much more of a handle here. I think it's very difficult to get out there into the political arena anything which isn't a soundbite. And I think unless we can find a way to do that, or to bring about a kind of political realignment so the party machines and the policy machines will take up conflicting positions on these issues, that is, if you like, the other way to get actual informed, serious discussion about whether, you know, you want to have your brain implants. Now, did you have a question? You didn't. Okay, that's fine. At the back.
But part of that has to do, I'm just asking you, because you had said that now it seems like we here in this country don't look at science the same as maybe we did years ago. Could part of the problem be the education piece, and if, say, children are more educated, and given that means to have to go into the school systems to get more qualified and educated teachers to be able to teach bioethics and nano technology and all of this, that maybe say another, say 15, 20 years, it may change and people will understand more, because right now, I'll tell you point blank, when I went to school, they didn't talk anything about the basics, you know. So could that be one main topic? And I'm not just saying just in the United States. I know we're back behind other countries in science, but you're telling us that they don't teach girls science in math like they do guys, and you know, all that good stuff. Could that be one thing that can help change our views here?
Well, sure. I mean, I think you're right. I think part of the problem we have in, you know, for what it's worth, my view of public education, well, having, you know, had five children all gone through it. Is the teaching of critical thinking. You know, it's the meta disciplines. I mean, I'd love them to do, you know, philosophy of science as well as science and so on and so forth. Now, not a lot of that happens at all in our educational system. Certainly not its earlier years, where actually I think there are particular benefits to getting people thinking self-consciously about what they're doing rather than just doing it. And obviously one of the problems with teaching to tests and so on and so forth is it discourages, unless you then have some sort of national standard in philosophy of science, which all 9-year-olds have to meet. You know, let's get, you know, I mean, Thomas Kuhn is full of sound bites. I mean, there's no reason why you can't, you know, break this up for them, you know. And they could have these games, you know, that, you know, this is what I see and this is what you see. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know, but my sense is remarkably little has happened of that kind. And this is not just true, but it's true to a teaching philosophy, metaphysics and so on, and so, in general, and you know, an awareness of, I mean, critical theory, literature and so on. We tend to cram children and expect them, when they get into their mid-late teens and they come up to a sort of college level, suddenly to be able to think critically. And I think basically, you know, we've done it all the wrong way round. You know, some of you know, there's a famous essay by Dorothy Sayers, the English essayist and amateur theologian and novelist and whatnot, called On Teaching the Wrong Tool or something. Anyway, basically it's all about this question of inversion and the trivium and the quadrivium and classical education and so on. The title was On Putting the Clock Back in Education. That was the title of the essay. But I mean, I think the nano thing interests me because they have K-12 nano education being funded by the National Science Foundation at, I think, Northwestern University in Chicago and elsewhere. Now, who knows what these guys are doing? It'd be interesting to find out. A little project there. Someone wants looking for a project. Are they teaching 7-year-olds to think critically about nanotechnology? Are they teaching them that little things are fun and beneficial? Now, I'll wager, if you want people to go into nanotechnology, quite apart from if you want people to go into policy in a way that's informed, you want them to become citizens who actually can contribute to the democracy rather than just, you know, help it slide down toward the ultimate sort of, you know, monosyllabic soundbite future, which I think is where we're going, you will try to find ways, do prime ways to get 7-year-olds to think critically about the meaning of technology. We all know 7-year-olds are highly intelligent people. And there are all sorts of ways in which you could get through the whole system critical thinking about technology, which basically is what we would call bioethics, if that's a term we have to end up using. It's an ugly word, but it's the word we have. And I think this actually would help us get people into science and engineering. It wouldn't discourage them from doing it, and it would get them into it in a far more sort of coherent way. I mean, I was just sitting in that nice lounge at the Inn at Penn this afternoon, looking over my notes, and some of you will know that the lounge there, where they have all these books. It's one of these sort of, you know, books by the yard things. Well, I mean, sitting next to me, I mean, there were sort of books about the history of medicine. There was Balzac, you know. There was sort of Harvard classics, which weren't even in numerical order, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, this is the context in which you have to think about these technology questions. Which is why people like Neal Stephenson are so important, you know, who I think is certainly our most provocative science fiction writer, whose books are almost all 1,000 pages long. And certainly his book, The Diamond Age, about nanotechnology, I think is the most brilliant book about technology, for all its oddities. How many of you read The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson? Boys and girls, no. Well, I think there's something which we seem to disagree. it's just a brilliant book. It's about a nanotechnology environment in which basically everything is possible. And as he says, because everything was possible, the question people were addressing was what was desirable. But I think it's one reason why narrative, particularly in science fiction, is the context in which we are trained to think. So, I mean, when I get approached by faculty members at conferences and so on, whether they're in sort of seminaries or colleges or whatever, and they say, well, I think you're right, this is really much more important than we are, what can I do? And I say, well, offer an elective on science fiction. You can probably just go do that, call your department chair. I mean, that's an easy thing to do, whatever the discipline you're meant to be teaching. Find some way to slot it in. And so all of a sudden, science fiction reflected upon is perhaps the sort of, you know, easiest, cheapest, dirtiest way to get into this question of getting K-12. What is the meaning of technology, and how are we going to be able to cope with the Kurzweilian vision coming true? Yes.
I think I will stand because I'm too small. Okay, I'm European. I'm not British though.
Where are you from?
The accent.
Where are you
Shall
from?
Shall I ask you? An intuition.
Are you from Romania?
I don't know.
Romania?
We met. We met before.
Have we?
Yes. I'm glad you remember where. And when. Okay.
I wonder what you're going to say next.
No, not
that.
And my questions are not necessarily related to nanotechnology. Roughly. I have in my hands a very interesting introduction, and I have to say thank you to you for coming and speak to us today. I've never heard you lecturing, and I'm enamored with the way you present things, precisely because you have this British sense of humor. We have another kind of sense of humor over there in my country of empires. And I also like the way you write. It's just an amazing way. I wish I were able to do that. So this is an introduction to the book. Maybe my colleagues heard about that you edited a couple of years ago, Human Dignity in the Biotech Century, A Christian Vision for Public Policy. And I have two questions for you. One is related to the public education question that my colleague was concerned with, somehow related to that. So you mentioned in that introduction that, quote, Christians should never be anti-science or anti-progress, and I know that some of them are not. Part of the creation mandate is to make life on Earth better, and science advances to just that. The more science discovers about DNA, the more it reveals that we are the product of an intelligent design. What is your opinion on controversy concerning the intelligent design theory in public schools in the United States? And I'm sure my colleagues will be very content to hear your answer if I framed the question well.
You framed
and
it.
The
you framed
second question.
The second question.
Maybe we'll let him do. Maybe we'll let him do one, Anna, because
going back to bioethics.
Anna, maybe we'll let him do one because I think there are other people also. This is a good question for our class, but
yeah, but
we want to
just
make sure.
A brief one. Going back to your opponent.
A brief one. My opponent. Yes.
Peter Singer.
Peter Singer. Yes.
Peter Singer.
We all need, Peter Singer is a wonderful man.
You mentioned, yeah, I met him too, that Christians believe that God's truth can be empirically validated, whereas Peter Singer's utilitarian view on morality cannot. Could you please explain how can divine revelation can be empirically validated?
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll try to answer some of this. I'm not sure I would claim it can be empirically validated. I mean, that might be a metaphor. I think the whole point of people have very different view of the world, and all view of the world from a Christian point of view are capable, many view of the world, are capable of a degree of validation. This is the whole point about what religious people call faith. So I think you can be perfectly credible and highly intelligent and take different views on religious questions. But on the question of intelligent design, well, I think it all depends how you want to define intelligence and how you want to define design. This is, if you like, the other controversy which lurks beneath the crust in North America, and which it certainly, if you start talking about being critical of science, there was a controversy in Britain, which is relevant, and I'll briefly mention this, about a year ago, when the Director of Education at the Royal Society, you know, which is the British Academy of Sciences, ended up resigning. He's a distinguished distinguished academic. Ended up resigning, going back to his university position, because he said he thought it would be good for kids to teach them the evolution creation design argument. I think he was there. I don't think he had any. Michael Rice, I think his name is Rice Reese. I don't think he had any skin in the game. I don't think he was a traditional standard, you know, evolutionary sort of guy. But he happened to dare make the point. It could be good for children to understand there are real arguments about how you interpret scientific evidence. It's part of my point about philosophy of science, point about Thomas Kuhn, you know. I mean, I just think you need to shake things up and get people thinking. And thinking is not typically, of course, what we get people to do in our school systems. So that was an interesting little controversy. And he was made to resign, even though there was a lot of embarrassment about it, because what he was saying was basically perfectly proper, that it can be good to get people thinking about dissident views. I think on intelligent design, I am reminded of a quote from a French theologian called, I think it was Alfred Loisy, who was a liberal French theologian around the turn of the 19th, 20th centuries, talking about something quite different. But the quotes stay with me, because I had to write an essay about it when I was at Cambridge, and I remember thinking, this is a rather neat way of putting things. He was talking about something quite different, and he said that this theory is either uninteresting or it is incredible. And I think there's something of that about intelligent design. I think if you're a theist, you have ultimately, by definition, no way of understanding the universe except as something which is intelligently designed, whatever the mechanisms involved. And so at one level, it is truism. I mean, theism is theism is theism. And there are many kinds of theists, but if you're a theist, you take this sort of view of reality as being something which actually, you know, got there somehow. I think, on the other hand, if by this you mean that you can poke holes in neo-Darwinism or whatever the latest version of it is and find a kind of God of the intelligent design gaps, God of the gaps being, of course, a sort of Victorian way of arguing about creation and evolution, that there were gaps and therefore only God could interpret how this happened to this. And interestingly, rather curious, I think Francis Collins' rather curious statement about the development of consciousness or conscience or whatever it was rather falls into this category, which is a complete other discussion, because he's very much a sort of evolutionist, towing the line guy, but even he was raising a question about some development in the human psyche. And I think it is incredible. I mean, I don't know entirely what I think about some of the questions. I do think there are bigger debates out there than orthodoxies tend to impose I'm always suspicious of the people who say all experts believe, because this always suggests to me a position which ultimately is going to shift, like all positions in science they have to shift, which is why Thomas Kuhn is always so refreshing, even if he's also confusing with his rather fuzzy idea of a paradigm. But I think I would take the view that if you are a theist, and Christians by and large are theists, you have no option but to believe in intelligent design. Whether you want to use that as a way of unpicking neo-Darwinism, I think, is a second-order question, which you're welcome to talk about over coffee. But I don't think it's the first-order question. I think I've survived your question.
One more question.
Yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering, so it sounds like there's the potential for ethics or bioethical issues to be marginalized by being included in various contexts that you've described, like in the nanotech conferences, and then there's a way in which there's a potential for being marginalized in political debates. So in terms of, I guess, an attempt to demarginalize it, what is the best route? Is the best route some sort of educational strategy, or do you, it sounds like in some way you think it should be brought more into policy, but in some ways...
Sure. Well, it's a great question to end with. Thank you very much, and you'll get your $10 afterwards. I give two responses. I mean, I think one, if you like, and I can put it in these terms since we're old friends here and we're not being tape recorded, but of course we are. Basically, is if you like, it's K-12 Kuhn. You know, K-12 Kuhn, basically getting people to think critically about science and technology, getting into the meta-disciplines, just using education, at least at college level and above, you know, to get people to think about why they think what they think, to take seriously the outlier views, the critical views, not to dismiss them, to be suspicious of orthodoxies, and to accept that there are various ways of understanding evidence and so on. I think that would be huge, huge, hugely beneficial. Secondly, basically, of course, we have an advert here for CPET, which, as Dr. Marino indicated, is this new think tank. Well, over the last 2 or 3 years, a number of us have been getting together in Washington, in which he is an esteemed partner. Which involves people of all kinds of political and ethical and, you know, religious views, which specifically is intended to try and focus the policy community, not primarily by talking about bioethics, even though obviously many of these issues can be framed in those terms, but talking about risk, getting investors, getting in people from the industrial sector, corporate sector, getting technology gurus into the conversation, about the policy implications of technology, and then invite the NGOs in to raise the substantive issues, which in fact often drive policy, and I think often well drive policy. So I think, I mean, if you like, well, if you want to put this in a sort of equation or something, rather than sort of bio plus ethics equals policy, sort of risk plus technology, plus NGOs. I mean, something like that as a sort of a way of framing the question. Now, as you can see, I mean, you know, doesn't the we're leaving ethics out of this? Ethics basically is impinging every step of the way here. But guess what? You've got the grown-ups around the table, if I can put it in those terms.
Repeat that, please.
How do we get the abortion question out of the way so we can get on? Well, I will risk giving you a brief answer to this question, which is you overturn Roe. And if you overturn Roe, all of a sudden, a lot of interesting things happen. Jeffrey Rosen had a piece in The Atlantic about this a couple of years ago, very interesting piece. Basically, abortion rates almost unchanged. People use Greyhound. States have political debates about a political issue. It's a far healthier way of handling these things. I think if the pro-life movement were pushing for Roe to be overturned, I think probably other people will be pushing for it to be overturned. I think this is part of the sort of superstructure of American culture, which has developed in a way which leaves many of us no alternatives but to take certain positions. But I think, for example, if that were to happen, immediately the issue is taken off the agenda in the defining way it has been on the agenda. But secondly, I mean, what has abortion got to do with, you know, brain implants? Difficulty is, almost all the ethical steam in the culture has been taken up with another issue. I think brain implants, well, you know, I've spoken to pro-life leaders about these things. I'm very candid with my view. You can Google me and find out what I really think about pretty much everything. And I will say these things to them, that ultimately reshaping human nature is on a different dimension from our debates about whether and when humans are humans and whether or not you should be able to take their lives. I think there are supernal questions, transcendent questions involved in the application of technology to reshape the human species, which I think will get many of us on very, very similar sort of conversations. We won't all agree, but they will be very different sort of lines of demarcation. And to be candid, I can see a lot of very religious people who are very pro-life on abortion not caring tuppence about brain implants, and in fact wanting to get better brain implants so they can be more effective in campaigning on abortion. And I can see people, you know, who are pro-choice on abortion having little interest in the kind of choice that will be foreclosed by a society which is dominated by these technologies. So it seems to me this basically, you know, pushes all the pieces off the board. And then you've got to find how we play another game. And that's a game I'm looking forward to playing, I hope, with many of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So those of you who are fortunate enough to be in the biopolitics course will hear a rather different view on the Roe question next week from Frances Kissling. So that'll
herself.
Be a very nice bookend to hearing about biopolitics and that issue. And I just want to say that the people who have come to dinner tonight, would you please assemble here, and we'll all move over there in about 5 minutes. And let's thank Professor Cameron again for a fantastic.
Should probably be off.
It's still going.
Yeah.
Hi, people.